Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. Israeli ground troops pushed into a crowded neighborhood of Gaza City for the first time today. They hit a hospital with shells, several high-rises, and the UN headquarters in Gaza City, setting the compound on fire. The UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, who is in the area on a mission trying to stop the escalating war with Hamas, expressed outrage with that bombing. Today is the 20th day of the offensive, which Israel launched in an effort to stop Hamas from firing rockets and missiles from Gaza into communities of hundreds of thousands of Israelis. 25 years ago, Hamas, which is an acronym in Arabic for the Islamic Resistance Movement, was a loosely knit group of social organizers and religious charities working on the margins of Palestinian society. At the time, in the early 80s, its so-called military wing and the name Hamas didn't even exist. And outside the Gaza Strip, even most Palestinians didn't pay it much attention. Today, Hamas is the dominant military and political force in Gaza, a popular vehicle for Palestinian rage and resistance, a fierce combatant in the ugly war with Israel that rages now. The rise of Hamas is a story cloaked in many layers of intrigue and controversy, and one that Yossi Melman has been covering for years. He is the intelligence and military affairs correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and he's in Tel Aviv. Hello.
Good morning.
First of all, what is Hamas?
In Middle Eastern terms, Israeli terms, it is considered to be a very radical organization. It has two, three functions or wings or branches. One is the political branch, one is the economic, social, welfare structure, and then they have a military wing or a terrorist organization, if you like, and their methods are, of course, mainly terrorist methods.
Okay. I want you to listen for a moment to a clip that I have from Vincent Canestraro. He is the former chief of operations and analysis for the CIA's counter-terrorist center. He did that from 1988 until 1991. This is what he says about the origins of Hamas.
The Israelis adopted very conciliatory moves towards Hamas, seeing it as an antagonist of Fatah, which is a political secular organization. Hamas, as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, was seen as a religious Islamic party and opposed to the political orientation of Fatah and the PLO. And the Israelis saw them as a way of countering Fatah, to weaken it and reduce its role by fostering and leaving alone Hamas. They weren't prosecuted against, they weren't pressured against. And so, in effect, they had a clear road to assert their position as a major Palestinian group with influence in Gaza and the West Bank.
Okay, well, that was Vincent Canestraro. Yossi Melman, how accurate is his recounting of the early relationship with Hamas?
It's true that the Israeli government didn't do anything to stop them, and was ready to allow the flow of money, which basically came from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. This is the only role which Israel played, if you want, in the surfacing and the creation of Hamas. Israel did not support Hamas because there is lots of myths around the world, like it is a creation of the Israeli intelligence.
In hindsight, is there anything Israel could have or should have done in those earlier days?
Well, maybe they should have stopped the easy way of Hamas receiving funds from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Had Israel had a vision, had Israel had was not that short-sighted. But that's the only thing that Israel could have done, because in the late 80s, Israel defined Hamas as an enemy and started fighting Hamas.
And was this around the time of the First Intifada then?
The decisive moment when it was created and founded was, if I'm not mistaken, in 87, the same year when the First Intifada uprising broke out. But this is a pure coincidence. Some people tend to identify the uprising with the creation of Hamas. It has nothing to do in common with those two developments, which were separated, and eventually they converged. Hamas was created, declared its creation by having their charter, publishing their charter, which refers to the land of Israel, Israel included, not only Palestine, as a holy land in religious terms, in Muslim terms, as waqf, which means a holy land, and therefore Israel doesn't have any right to exist. There is no, they don't recognize Israeli and Jewish sovereignty on this land, which is a Muslim land, and from that moment they were part of the Palestinian uprising together with the PLO. They were surprised by the spontaneous initiative by the people. It started in Gaza, by the way. That's why also more credit is given to Hamas.
But, and it started in the Jabalia refugee camp, too, right?
Yes, it started in refugee camp. The trigger was just a road accident.
So let's shoot ahead to December 1992. There's an incident. Israel deports 400 members of Hamas to southern Lebanon. Why did it do that, and how significant was that to the future growth, the future direction of Hamas?
Well, it shows you that Israel, first of all, treated them as a bitter enemy. And secondly, for many, many years, Israel has believed, I think wrongly, that by demolishing houses and by deporting activists or terrorists, it would be able to reduce their violence and to reduce the will of the Palestinian people to fight for their freedom and independence. So in 1992, in the middle of the Intifada, Israel deported these 400 activists and deported them to Lebanon. And by doing it, Israel was instrumental in cementing the movement. This was like their maturity test. And when they eventually returned to the territories, they became the heroes and the leaders of Hamas.
One of them was a man named Yahya Ayash. Tell us who he was and what he did, what he became.
He was the technological expert, if you wish, of Hamas. He was the guy who mastered the art of explosives, and he was behind many, many terrorist attacks inside Israel, which were initiated by Hamas. He helped them to build these bombs. He taught some of his disciples and students how to prepare explosives. And with these explosives, suicidal bombers were sent into Israel in the mid-90s. And eventually, the Israeli intelligence managed to get hold of him, got very close to him by an informer who was one of his associates. The associate who it turned out, was an agent of the Israeli intelligence, provided Yahya Ayash with his mobile phone. This mobile phone was treated by the Israeli intelligence earlier. They planted a bomb inside, instead of the battery, inside the battery, and the bomb was activated by an Israeli drone.
And was it a good idea to kill him? Did it work?
It never works in the sense that you kill one terrorist, they multiply. They immediately is replaced by more terrorists. And it only strengthens the will of the group. However, for a side like Israel, there is no other alternative. It is a war, and you have to continue fighting them. But it's not sufficient for a country only to fight terrorism. A state, a government needs also to find solutions. So if you do both, you provide diplomatic, political solutions to the other side, and at the same time you fight the terrorists, maybe it is helpful and significant.
Now, if we move ahead, that was 1996 that they killed the engineer, Yahya Ayash, was it not?
Yeah. Just before the Israeli elections, by the way, which eventually caused in a kind of a strange chain reaction, caused the election of Prime Minister Shimon Peres. He was defeated by his opponent, Bibi Netanyahu of the Likud, because of the killing of Yahya Ayash in a very strange chain of reaction. Peres was depicted as a soft, weak on terrorism, and because of that he approved the operation. He gave the green light for the intelligence community, for the domestic security service, the Shabak, to run the operation. In response, the Hamas emerged on a wave of suicidal attacks inside Israel. The mood of Israel turned against Peres. He, in order to improve his ratings, he ordered the Israeli military to launch an operation into Lebanon, which turned to be a fiasco, and he lost his election.
Hmm. And Bibi Netanyahu came to power?
Yes, in 96.
And then in 1997, under Netanyahu, Israel released the Hamas leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin from prison and allowed his return to Gaza. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, there was no thinking. It was forced upon Israel to do it. Israel, with the same kind of notions, Bibi Netanyahu, there were two major attacks, suicidal attacks, or just, if I'm not mistaken, one suicidal attack and one just a bomb exploded in the Machane Yehuda market in Jerusalem, which is a very popular place. And Netanyahu was under pressure, public pressure, so to speak, and he went to the Mossad and asked them, please revenge, or please provide me with a list of Hamas terrorists who should be killed. Netanyahu approved to the Mossad to get rid, to kill Khaled Mashal in Amman. The operation, by the way, in which Israeli agents use Canadian passports, failed, and King Hussein was furious how Israel could have violated his sovereignty, and he was a friend of Israel, an ally of Israel, and he demanded two things. First of all, that Israel would save the life of Khaled Mashal. He was the assassination attempt on his life was by using sarin, by using a poison. And that was ordered with the aim that the cause of death would not be known. So it would seem as he died of natural causes. So he was taken to hospital. He was dying, and Hussein demanded that Israel would save his life by sending a doctor with the antidote, which Israel did. And also King Hussein of Jordan demanded that as a gesture to Hamas, Israel would release from its jail the spiritual leader and the founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin.
So if we look at Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the spiritual leader, he is a man in a wheelchair. I remember interviewing him, a tiny little, almost squeaky little voice, a spiritual leader, comes back to Gaza. There's a huge rally. And the feeling was that he would not live long. He was ill.
Well, he lived almost another decade until he was assassinated by the Israeli intelligence in 2004, if I'm not mistaken.
So what did his release at the time mean for Hamas?
It gave a lot of boosting to Hamas, but one has to admit that while he was alive, he was kind of a moderate force had a great influence on Hamas and became a moderate one. He was the one who founded Hamas. He was the one who declared that this land is a Muslim land. But at the same time, he was talking to the Israelis while he was in jail. He met with several intelligence people and he knew that they were intelligence. And they talked to him about the future, about the prospect of peace.
Now, Sheikh Yassin was eventually killed by Israel. What was the decision behind that?
The Palestinians were conducting a heavy war against Israel, terrorist war against Israel, and Israel reciprocated and responded by escalating the war. And eventually, Sheikh Yassin and the top echelon of the Hamas, his lieutenants, his associates, and a few more leaders gathered together in a house, and Israel dropped a bomb on this house and killed all of them.
Okay. Well, Yossi Melman, you've got a lot of years following this. Thank you for your perspective today.
Thank you very much.
That's Yossi Melman. He's the intelligence and military affairs correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He spoke to us from Tel Aviv. You are listening to The Current on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite Radio 137. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Well, Hamas solidified its control over Gaza 2 years ago when its gunmen fought a bitter battle with Fatah, the main Palestinian organization linked to the PLO, and won. According to David Rose, the story behind that battle is one shrouded in secrecy and formed in conspiracy. David Rose is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair magazine, and last year he wrote an investigative article called The Gaza Bombshell. He joins us from Oxford, England. Hello.
Hi there.
What did you learn about what started happening in Washington immediately after the Palestinian elections of January 2006 and the victory for Hamas?
Yes, well, I do think this is the critical place to start to analyze what is happening now and the origins of the humanitarian catastrophe that is now unfolding with the international community apparently powerless to stop it in Gaza today. I should say I've just returned from the region this week. The election of 2006 had been urged upon the Palestinians by the United States. It was part of President Bush's program for democracy in the Middle East and can be seen in the same context, for example, his hope of bringing democracy to Iraq. Now, he was warned by the Fatah party, by the secular party that had been led by Yasser Arafat before his death in 2004, is now led by Abu Mazen, President Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. He had been warned that Fatah was likely to lose this election because Fatah was widely perceived in both Gaza and the West Bank, the other Palestinian-occupied territory, as being corrupt, as having received many billions of dollars in foreign aid, a large percentage of which had been embezzled. And indeed, as one prominent Fatah member told me earlier this week, the Fatah leadership had begun to live, as he put it, like princes, while for ordinary people, life had barely improved. And so Hamas was able to capitalize on that very wide feeling of dissatisfaction.
So when they won, how did Washington react?
Well, as soon as they won, in concert with what's called the Quartet, that is the coalition of the US, the UN, the European Community and Russia, which has this sort of strange kind of supervisory role on Middle East diplomacy, they issued conditions that they knew Hamas could not accept, that they immediately dropped the demand that Israel cease to exist, that they repudiate the charter and that they cease all acts of violence, and of course that they also accept agreements that the Fatah Palestinian leadership had signed
right.
up to.
Right. I'm going to move you on here, David, because we don't have a lot of time and you've got some confidential stuff. So that's the history. We know that nobody wanted to deal with Hamas. What was going on behind the scenes in Washington that you have since learned?
Well, what was going on behind the scenes is that really from the moment of the Palestinian elections, neoconservative forces within the Bush administration started to conspire with elements of the Fatah leadership, especially in Gaza. And the man they called our guy was a man called Mohammed Dahlan. Now, as leader of the Palestinian Preventive Security Organization in Gaza in the mid-90s, Dahlan had been responsible for a wave of torture, arbitrary detention, and other human rights abuses, mainly against Hamas members, but also people who were merely suspected of being Hamas members, who were in fact nothing of the kind. He was widely hated by Hamas members. And what they started doing was making him extravagant promises that they would devise a covert program to supply him with weaponry in the hope that he would eventually topple the Hamas leadership.
You actually found a memo that where they said we will support you both materially and politically.
That's
so
right.
They put it in writing.
Well, in fact, I uncovered a number of memos, which I may say came not from US, but Palestinian sources by people within the Palestinian establishment who were disgusted what their own leadership had contemplated. And yes, they evolved a series of secret agreements. Now, in public, what was happening was a kind of political rapprochement between Hamas and Fatah. They formed in the beginning of 2007 a so-called National Unity Government after a summit in Mecca in Saudi Arabia. But Even as that agreement was being concluded, the Saudis themselves were party to this covert program to supply Fatah in Gaza with weaponry. And the Egyptians, who are now supposedly the peace brokers, the people who are trying to negotiate a ceasefare with Hamas and have been the mediators between Israel and Hamas for the last many months, were in fact training Fatah forces led by Dahlan in Egypt. Now, it was when those forces started to come back into Gaza in the summer of 2007, newly trained and newly armed, that Hamas took preventive action. And as many observers on the ground agree, what took place was not a coup by Hamas, but in fact a kind of preventive counter-coup. They saw their power being bloodily ended in Gaza by these secret Fatah forces, and they decided to put a stop to it before it began.
So in other words, these other powers outside, including Washington, were trying to start a civil war amongst the Palestinian forces, the factions.
They didn't just try, they succeeded.
They succeeded. There was a huge fight.
Yes, absolutely. And hundreds of people died. And before the final stages in May and June 2007, hundreds of people on both sides were tortured. Indeed, that kind of action continues. I mean, you only have to look at the Palestinian human rights reports to see that both sides are continuing to torture their opponents, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. Yes, this was an outside instigated attempt to destroy Hamas politically from within. I would like to make one very important point.
Mm-hmm, go ahead.
Behind this lay an analysis of Hamas, and indeed behind the current war lies an analysis of Hamas that I believe is fundamentally flawed.
And what's that?
Israel believes that Hamas is unique, that it does not respond on a political level, unlike every other terrorist organization that has ever existed in recent history. It completely rejects, for example, the model of the Northern Ireland peace process, where the militants were isolated by the moderates, such as Gerry Adams, who were eventually able to coax the Republican movement into negotiations with the British government. And finally, of course, we've had lasting peace in Northern Ireland now for more than 10 years. Now, there are a number of very prominent moderates in the Hamas leadership, and I've spent a lot of time with them in the last few days, and they are beyond dismay, because what they see is that the isolation of Hamas, the refusal to entertain even the possibility that Hamas might be allowed to rule successfully in Gaza and perhaps lead, that they could perhaps lead the movement towards a more constitutional, less violent role, because that wasn't even entertained, they've been marginalized within the movement. The movement has become, of course, even more committed to violence, and the prospects for a political solution have frankly receded far beyond the horizon, and nobody I met in the Palestinian territories believes that any kind of peace deal is likely in their lifetime.
So let me ask you, because you have just returned from there and you've talked to people both in Fatah and Hamas, given the what you're telling us about how other countries were involved in setting these two off against each other as well, can they even work together, Fatah and Hamas?
As things stand, the prospects for a kind of reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah are extremely remote. I'm going to be writing a story for a British newspaper this weekend describing the wave of torture and oppression that's been taking place in the West Bank by the Palestinian Authority and its security forces, who, by the way, are also American-trained and supplied.
They're Fatah.
These are Fatah forces.
Mm-hmm.
They have been arresting hundreds of people in the recent months. Many of them have been horribly tortured, and some of them have absolutely nothing to do with Hamas. I mean, there was one guy I met, a professor of political science at the University of Nablus, who was tortured so badly that he lost the sight in both eyes and the use of both legs severe beatings. And he has no connection with Hamas at all. His crime was to have criticized the Palestinian leadership.
David
on television.
Rose, we have to leave it there, but thank you for your insights this morning.
Thank you.
David Rose is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair magazine. He spoke to us from Oxford, England. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, 9 o'clock in Newfoundland and parts of Labrador, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, send us your comments. Visit our website at cbc.ca/thecurrent, then click on Contact Us. Or call our feedback line, 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.